This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Leading members of the Democrat Party have even launched a campaign to abolish ICE. In other words, they want to abolish America's borders. We have the worst laws anywhere in the world. Nobody has laws like the United States.
I believe you should get rid of it, start over, reimagine it.
We need the wall. We need our immigration laws changed. We need strong people to handle those people. We don't play games, right? We don't play games.
Hello and welcome to Trumpcast. I'm Leon Krause. I'm a journalist at Univision based in Los Angeles, California. That's the way it should be pronounced. I'm also the host of El Gafest, our first podcast in Spanish, a Spanish language take on American politics here in Slate. I'm also very happy to say that I've also recently become a columnist for Slate, and I'm very proud to be your host for today's show. Now, even by the historically low standards of Donald Trump's chaotic, infuriating, schoolyard bully presidency, this week has been quite something. Just when the president was trying to catch some air after the inconvenient and very public venting of his former employee and reality show colleague Omarosa Manigault Newman, Tuesday gave Trump a legal and political double whammy. Paul Manafort, his former campaign manager, was found guilty of 8 counts of financial crimes and now faces many, many decades in jail. And even worse, Michael Cohen, Mr. Trump's personal lawyer, dear friend and trusted consigliere, pled guilty to 8 federal crimes, including illegal contributions to benefit then-candidate Trump's campaign at the apparent behest of Trump himself. Donald Trump reacted the way he usually does on Twitter and Fox News, where else. He tried to distance himself from the whole affair, again said there is no evidence whatsoever of collusion, suggested flipping itself should be illegal after decades of watching flippers, he said, and insisted that the only thing he's done wrong is win the 2016 election. Of course, he added his beloved witch hunt with capital letters. At least he didn't call Michael Cohen a dog. However things may end for Trump, one thing is certain by now. The president can now give Elon Musk a run for his money as America's most sleep-deprived, anxiety-ridden man, although Musk is only facing the capitulation of his entrepreneurial dreams, not the disgraceful end of a presidency. As usual, sadly, lost among all this are the consequences of Trump's policies on the lives of millions of Americans with and without documents. Trump's deportation machine simply knows no bounds. In a moment, I will ask Frank Foer, who wrote a terrifying piece in The Atlantic earlier this month on the radicalization of ICE, about how the Trump administration is turning fear into big business. But first, let's do some tweets.
If anyone is looking for a good lawyer, I would strongly suggest that you don't retain the services of Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to 2 counts of campaign finance violations that are not a crime. President Obama had a big campaign finance violation, and it was easily settled. A large number of counts, 10, could not even be decided in the Paul Manafort case. Witch hunt. I feel very badly for Paul Manafort and his wonderful family. Justice took a 12-year-old tax case, among other things, applied tremendous pressure on him, and unlike Michael Cohen, he refused to break. Make up stories in order to get a deal. Such respect for a brave man. No collusion, rigged witch hunt.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little
or a lot. Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Joining me from the Atlantic studio in Washington, D.C. is Frank Foer. Frank has been on this show before with Jacob and Virginia to discuss all things Paul Manafort, which we'll also touch on here at the end of the show. But to kick things off, we're talking about ICE and Frank's cover story in the Atlantic this month about the radicalization of the agency. Frank, thank you for joining me on the show.
My great pleasure.
I would like to begin by asking you to briefly share with us the history of ICE. The agency has grown dramatically in recent years, but it's only existed for just over a decade and a half, right?
So it was created in 2003 along with the department that houses it, the Department of Homeland Security. But I think we need to go back a little bit further in the history of American immigration to understand the emergence of ICE, which is that we've always policed our borders. Sometimes we spent a lot of money on it, sometimes not a whole lot of money, but that's the border. And there is this whole other realm of immigration enforcement, which relates to the interior of the country. ICE was created in the shadow of 9/11. And so after 9/11, where we started to be panicked about forces that existed in the country who we weren't tracking or who were other, and this began this this trajectory where immigration enforcement was ballooning, but it began to just grow at this exponential sort of rate. And by the year 2012, the government was spending more on immigration enforcement than it was spending on the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, the U.S. Marshals Service combined, $18 billion a year. And it's just an incredible expenditure of money. And it's devoted to, a lot of this is devoted to the, ICE is devoted to the interior of the country. It's about removing immigrants, not at the border. It's about deporting them in many cases when they've settled here. There are 11 million undocumented immigrants in the country right now, two-thirds of whom have been here for a decade or longer.
Now, before we explore the ways ICE has changed since Donald Trump took office, I would like to go back a little bit. For the first two or three years of the Obama administration, as you point out, the government had a very active enforcement strategy that disappointed many pro-immigrant groups. I remember this very clearly as a Univision journalist. I covered it. Why did Obama, you think, a president who had actually promised immigration reform, take such an aggressive stance on deportation, at least at first?
Well, there's the surface explanation and perhaps a deeper explanation. I think the surface explanation is that Obama was striving to get comprehensive immigration reform, this grand bargain with Republicans, where in exchange for tougher enforcement, there would be some form of amnesty for the 11 million. And so Republicans were constantly criticizing Obama, saying, we don't really believe that you're sincere about enforcing immigration laws. You have to prove it to us. And so Obama set out to prove it to them. And so he was deporting.
So he was naive.
There was an element of naivete there. There was this it was an asymmetrical negotiation. It was just bad negotiation where he was giving the Republicans everything that they wanted without exacting anything in return. And also he was playing politics too, because so much of American politics since the Clinton era has dictated that both parties seek to flex their muscles on the immigration issue, that Democrats couldn't show weakness on the issue or they would lose certain swing states. I think there's maybe even a deeper reason, which is it's not just naivete. I think it was indifference. I just don't think that immigration was an issue that animated Obama. I don't think that he, I don't think he thought that much about the issue or was curious about that issue. That's at least the impression that I get from talking to people in his inner circle.
So you think he in he didn't really care that much about the issue itself. He cared about other things, and that's how he prioritized. Especially in that first term, he went for healthcare reform instead of delivering immigration reform. No, to the disappointment of those pro-immigrant groups that I mentioned.
Yeah, of course, and he obviously had to prioritize his agenda, and this was just the issue that he chose not to prioritize. But I do think so. Then the administration starts to pivot at a certain point when he realizes that immigration reform is a lost cause and that he's unleashed this enforcement mechanism, this enforcement apparatus, and that he then decides that he wants to constrain it. And so in 2011, John Morton, who was the director of ICE, puts out a series of guidelines, writes a memo trying to constrain ICE. And it's really hard to master the internal internecine politics of the agency, because the agency has its own worldview. The guys who work in the agency view themselves as cops, as law enforcement. And so the idea that they wouldn't arrest somebody who was flagrantly in violation of the law was anathema to them. And it was part of this longer running inferiority complex that the agency had, that it wasn't respected as law enforcement. But it really took The Morton was kind of an ineffectual director of ICE, and the Morton memos themselves were not especially useful. It took the second Obama term, Jay Johnson coming in, the crafting of more precise memos and regulations and a better articulation of the administration's enforcement priorities for the number of deportations to start to seriously shrink.
Now, I think by the end of the Obama years, like you say, ICE actions were indeed in many ways limited by prosecutorial discretion and by at least a clearer set of priorities. In many ways, if an immigrant had led an honest life in America, he or she could have at least some confidence that said life was not in any imminent danger of being uprooted. And then everything changed with Donald Trump. How so?
Well, so for starters, he threw out all of the priorities, all of the restraints that Obama imposed at the end of his administration. So where, as you say, if you were a law-abiding immigrant who'd been here for a decent period of time, you could expect to live in safety. By the time so Trump came in and he said, no, if you're here illegally without documentation, then we're going to you're subject to deportation. And if ICE comes across you, they have every right to detain you and to deport you. And that was kind of the beginning of this shift where the agency, which had felt like it had been handcuffed is the term, the trope that appears consistently in the way that the agency viewed itself. It had been handcuffed by Obama, and now it said the handcuffs were off. And so this was, ICE just has a huge amount of latitude. It has 11 million potential targets. It has an incredible amount of resources. It has agreements with local law enforcement agencies across the country where it can essentially deputize them to do its bidding. The administration has control over the immigration courts, which are not really courts in the sense that the criminal justice system works. They're administrators who work. Judges are administrators who work for the Department of Justice, and if the Attorney General gives them a set of instructions, they're obliged to follow them. And so the instructions that they were getting were to move cases more quickly, to strip away some of the protections that immigrants had in immigration court, and with the desired goal of dramatically and quickly increasing deportations.
You argue that Donald Trump has radicalized ICE well beyond the harshest years of the Obama presidency, and I find this very interesting. You say that he has done it to the point that this current version of the agency is, and I quote your piece, a deviation in the long history of American immigration. Why, Frank?
In part, it's not so much that they've increase the number of deportations to historic highs. The numbers of deportations right now are well off the pace set by the Obama administration in 2012 and 2013. What they've done, though, that's so different is that they've attempted to use the state, attempted to use their powers in order to inculcate a sense of fear among immigrants here. And the reason is doctrinal, that there's a philosophy that begins with Kris Kobach, who is currently he was Kansas Secretary of State. Now he's the Republican gubernatorial candidate in Kansas. And he came up with an idea called attrition through enforcement, which became very popular.
Right?
Yeah, self-deportation is what Mitt Romney and others called it. And the idea is that you increase the sense of price, the sense of terror that immigrants feel. You make it harder for them to operate, to maneuver, to make a living, to feel a sense of stability and security, with the hope that they come to the logical, rational, self-interested conclusion that their lives would be better if they voluntarily removed themselves from the United States.
I always believe that personnel is indeed policy. And when it comes to immigration, Donald Trump has surrounded himself not only with hardliners, but with voices who were, and you explained this beautifully in your piece, who were considered extreme even within immigration hawks in the Republican Party. Stephen Miller, USCIS Director L. Francis Cisna, who, by the way, is a son of an immigrant, Kris Kobach, who you just mentioned, and, of course, Jeff Sessions, who was for a long, long time the most anti-immigrant senator in Congress. Who are these people? I mean, what motivates all of them?
Right. So they were, most of these people worked together on Capitol Hill, and they worked in the offices of a handful of very extreme politicians, Jeff Sessions, Chuck Grassley, the senator, Republican senator from Iowa, Bob Goodlatte, who's congressman from Virginia. And, you know, the question of what motivates them, you know, it's you listen to Jeff Sessions, who is the godfather of this group. It's pretty clear that he worries about the rise of multicultural America, demographic changes in the country, the sense that what he would deem to be real Americans are strangers in their own homes. And you see that that's kind of the case throughout. Francis Cisna runs, who's a Department of Homeland Security bureaucrat who went to work for Senator Chuck Grassley and now runs a division of Homeland Security called USCIS, the Citizenship and Immigration Services. And his office, in its official motto, talked about the United States being a nation of immigrants. And one of his acts as head of this office was to expunge that phrase, nation of immigrants, from the organization's mission statement. And he said that the reason that he wanted to do that was to promote the interest, to make it clear that his agency was promoting the interests of the American people, as if there was tension between the idea that we were a nation of immigrants and that there's this group called the American people. And so I'm very hesitant to try to impugn somebody's motives, but you read the statements as they exist, and I think you do see this fear of the other as being an essential tenet of their thinking.
So it's nativism, it's cultural anxieties, it's social anxieties, but, and this is another part of your piece, Frank, it's also big business, right? The American immigration enforcement machine is big business.
Well, I mean, it's the whole Department of Homeland Security is big business. There are more contractors who work for the Department of Homeland Security than there are employers. And with ICE, you see this in particular. One of the things that has emerged since 2003 is that ICE has built up this network of detention facilities. Congress ordered ICE to rapidly expand its detention. There was a piece of legislation in 2004 that ordered them to increase detention capacity by at least 8,000 beds a year. And Senator Robert Byrd snuck into a piece of appropriations legislation, a quota that said that that ICE essentially had to fill 34,000 beds each night. And so you had, it's in this kind of era of outsourcing, this mania for outsourcing, ICE began to rely on private companies to build and operate detention facilities. And, you know, we see this in every part of government, the way in which it becomes a racket, and that the private companies who depend on the largesse of the state spend huge sums on lobbying, on hiring ex-officials, on working the system to try to get juicier and juicier contracts. And I just would argue that there's certain things that should not be outsourced and should not be privatized, because the market operates on the basis of profit. And by the way, our immigration system is a civil system. Immigration crimes are usually civil crimes, not criminal crimes. And so explicitly, it's said that detention is not meant to be punitive. It's meant to be it's meant to be civil. And so you have the system where these companies operate these facilities, which become Dickensian and hellish, because they're trying to save money every which way. And so if it comes to spending on healthcare or psychological care or even just basic food safety, they tend to skimp. And so every NGO that's filed reports on these facilities comes back with pretty ugly tales.
In the story you wrote for The Atlantic, and you did it just a few minutes ago as well, you keep coming back to that word, which is fear. I have seen this fear unfold within the Hispanic community in Los Angeles in the last few months or years now. In your experience, how have immigrants changed their routines?
I'd be curious to know what you've seen.
Yeah, in Los Angeles, I mean, we have clear data that people have stopped going to church, to school, to soccer games on weekends. People stopped buying cars looking for homes. I mean, they've really pressed the pause button on their lives out of sheer fear. That's just a fact of life now.
Yeah. Well, so in Los Angeles, there's evidence that immigrants are reluctant to go to the police to report crimes. And so
exactly, domestic abuse, no? Domestic violence.
Exactly. So rather if you're getting beaten by your husband, you don't want your husband to be deported. You don't want yourself to be deported inadvertently by reporting that crime. So it's just you leave it unreported. It's a pretty terrible thing. And the other thing that you were just describing, which I've seen as well, is just all the long-term decisions that you would make to kind of commit to that grow out of a sense of stability, whether it's investments in education, the decision to start a business, the decision to buy a car, the decision to save money. All these things are short-circuited because you can't count on being present here for the foreseeable future.
And you tackled your story from a very smart angle, in my opinion, which is you basically, Frank, stayed away from the Hispanic narrative, which is the dominant narrative nowadays, the one that I follow every single day in the Univision, and you chose to go into the story through the angle of Mauritanian refugees. Tell us about that.
So they're West Africans. Mauritania is a country that is predominantly Arab, but has black subpopulations who were more or less ethnically cleansed in the 1990s and then had to suffer extreme case of second-class citizenship ever since. And a group of them came, settled in Columbus, Ohio, and they were here for a very, very long period of time. Most of them came in about the year 2000, and they had what should have been a slam dunk asylum case to make. But immigrants are among the most vulnerable people in our society, and they're preyed upon by parasites. And so they had compatriots who volunteered to fill out or were paid to fill out their asylum applications. And so instead of taking their very compelling stories and rendering them the asylum applications, these compatriots, these translators who could speak English, just cut and paste generic stories and put them in. And immigration judges saw the pattern and started to reject their claims of asylum. But, you know, despite that fact, their deportation was just never a high priority for ICE. And so they were permitted to stay here. And so long as they checked in with ICE once a year. And, you know, over the years, if you're here 18 years, you start to feel a sense of permanence. And, you know, they didn't consider their deportation to be a live possibility anymore, so long as they kept their noses clean and just stayed on the right side of the law. And then Donald Trump came into power, and suddenly ICE started to demand that they check in once a month, and ICE mm-hmm. started to visit their homes, and pillars of the community started to get detained and deported. And I saw fear take hold in this community. I saw people begin to actually self-deport. Chris Kobach's dream was coming true, where the Mauritanians began to go to Canada and apply for asylum there, or they would disappear from Ohio altogether and go to New York, where it's easier to live underground. And it's terrible to see a community that had built stores and mosques and where parents raised kids who were U.S. citizens, suddenly fear for its life and slowly, maybe not so slowly, start to actually dissipate.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned a chilling statistic, 2/3 of the 11 million. Again, we should probably repeat the number. 11 million undocumented immigrants currently in the country have lived in the United States for more than a decade. I have one more number to throw at you and our listeners. 78% of undocumented Mexicans, just Mexicans, have lived here for more than 10 years. So we're talking about almost 5 million people. So that brings me to what I think is a crucial question, Frank.
It's also let's just pause to put those numbers in some context.
In perspective.
11 million is bigger than the size of Sweden. 5 million would be one of the major American metropolises. 5 million is more than it's bigger than Philadelphia. It's bigger than most American cities. These are not trivial numbers.
They are not. That's why I wanted to repeat the 11 million. Of course, the 5 million is enormous as well. And I think that begs this question. What makes a life worthy of being called and recognized as fully American nowadays? I mean, worthy of American belonging. Just last week, David Glosser, Stephen Miller's uncle, recounted his own family's story in America, how they made it in America, how they became American. And it was, frankly, not unlike Donald Trump's story, a grandson and son of immigrants. After 10 years, they were American in every way. Why are current immigrant lives not considered American lives, Frank? By some people, at least.
I mean, there is the technical matter, which is that our political system is so broken that we haven't found a mechanism for providing citizenship for these people, even though most of the American political system would endorse the idea of giving them citizenship. The majorities in both houses supported immigration reform, yet a small band of extremists have constantly found ways to detonate immigration reform. But why? I mean, so there's the technical matter of them actually not having citizenship, but then there's this this moral question of why they're not regarded as citizens by their fellow residents, by other people who live with them in their communities, or by Republican politicians. And there I think we're in the territory of having to discuss racism, which is a very uncomfortable thing for Americans to discuss. But I don't we treat people as the other because their skin is different, or their accent is different, or their customs are different, their culture is different, even though they've implanted themselves here. They are American. They're part of our communities. And that's what ultimately I find so horrifying about Trump policy, is that in effect, it's excising, its goal is to excise Americans from our community, from our midst. You're not dealing with people who are outside of our borders. You're dealing with people who are inside of our communities. The heartlessness, the dehumanizing way in which this policy treats the other, who are us, is just resonates for me with the patterns that we see in so many of the ugliest episodes in human history.
And so that begs a question, is there an antidote? I mean, what about the media, our role? Have we failed to tell the immigrant story properly, like you very clearly did in your piece in The Atlantic? Should we have more of that? Because after all, I go back to a travel ban and how it initially failed, and it failed because the American media told the stories of immigrants who couldn't come into the United States for their college studies or to see their grandkids or whatnot. I mean, they told the human story. Maybe we haven't told the human story of modern immigration in America properly.
Well, don't you think in the response to the zero tolerance policy at the border, family separations, also it was a policy failure because the media did a very good job of calling attention to the problem.
Yeah.
But there's also a way in which it's a fault of media, it's a fault of politicians. It's everybody has some blame, I think, to share in just being a nerd to the sad stories. There are so many sad stories, so many compelling stories. And when we look at them individually, they break your heart and then you move on. Mm-hmm. And I think the struggle is to really think about the problem in its entirety and to think about the problem comprehensively.
Let me switch gears before we let you go, Frank. I can't do so without getting your take on the dramatic conclusion of Paul Manafort's trial. Are we nearing, you think, the end of at least this Manafort fiasco, or is this only the beginning? What should we be looking for in September when that new trial, the second trial, begins? What's your take on what's happened this week?
Well, the most important. So, his guilt, I think, is an important milestone, but it was foreseeable and inevitable. The evidence against him was extremely strong. It would have been shocking if they hadn't achieved something close to this result. I think the surprising and important development of the week is the president himself dangling a pardon for Paul Manafort so obviously. And so we arrive at this moment where there's all sorts of gamesmanship being deployed. Paul Manafort looks ahead. He sees this next trial, which is in Washington, D.C., with a judge who's much less sympathetic to him, with counts that are much more serious that he's been charged with the government saying that it has 1,000 exhibits of evidence that it wants to use in the trial, which is nearly twice as many exhibits of evidence as they used in the last trial. So it's a stronger case that they're presenting with him. And for Paul Manafort to go forward with this next step it's an expensive proposition. It's an exhausting proposition. He's already gone through this once, and he may have even thought that he could have prevailed in the first trial. And I just think if you're sitting in jail right now, such a lonely place to be, knowing that you're on your way to prison, knowing that you've got this other trial to go through, I don't see how it doesn't break you at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the question, so there's these two questions. One is, will Trump deliver him a pardon in time that kind of before he reaches that moment of being broken where he decides that it's in his best interest to cooperate or he doesn't have the resources to go forward with another defense? You know, we don't know exactly what he would be able to deliver to Robert Mueller and whether it would be enough to get him a deal. I think Trump is acting as if he has something to fear in the form of Paul Manafort. I mean, I'm a little bit surprised that Trump is so terrified of the prospect of him flipping, which means that he probably does have some pretty good goods to deliver. to Robert Mueller.
Well, Trump seems to think now that flipping itself should be illegal. That's what he said.
That's what the Don says.
Classic Trump.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Frank, thank you so very much. What a pleasure to hear your voice and hear your opinions on this very painful topic and many others. I've been speaking with Frank Ford. His cover story in The Atlantic this month is how Trump radicalized ICE. He also wrote the definitive story on Paul Manafort, which you should check out as well. Frank, again, thank you for joining me on Trumpcast.
Nobody I'd rather talk these issues over with than you. Thank you.
And that's the show. Did you like it? I sure hope so. Let me know by tweeting at Real Trumpcast and tweeting at me at Leon Krause. Leon Krause sounds very complicated. It really isn't. I've always debated whether I should say Leon Krause or Leon Krause. In any case, it's at LeonKrauze. We would love to hear your feedback. What do you want us to talk about next? What's important to you that isn't getting the coverage you think it should on our podcast? Let us know again at Real Trumpcast. Our show today was produced by Jason DeLeon. John DiDomenico is, as always, our voice of Donald Trump. And I'm Leon Krause, or Leon Krause. Thanks again for listening to Trumpcast.